Okay, let's cultivate our motivation. And with a strong sense that wherever we're born in cyclic existence, whatever we do, that none of it will bring any lasting satisfaction. That none of it is certain or anything real. Then let's generate a strong intention to understand reality, to make our lives meaningful, and to free ourselves from the bonds of ignorance. And then looking around and seeing that other sentient beings are in the same situation, wanting happiness, but continually doing things that create suffering, making choices that are unwise. Then let's generate a strong determination ourselves to make wise choices, to practice the path, to actualize the path, for the purpose of leading others on the path to freedom, to full enlightenment. And so that's our long-term motivation for what we're doing this evening. Choices all the time, aren't we? And our choices create karma. Our choices are karma in some sense. You know, a choice is a mental factor of intention, isn't it? Yeah. But sometimes we don't really think about the choices that we're making very well. We just have a knee-jerk reaction. Or we just do habitual old choices, you know, because they're the same thing we've always chosen to do, so we just do them again. Or sometimes we're kind of really lazy to think about, you know, kind of what is a wise choice here and what isn't. Sometimes we're just out of control. You know, we don't even think about the choices we're making. The mind is just being pushed here and there. Sometimes the mind may be pushed here and there and we're aware of it and saying, this is not a good decision. This is not a good choice. And we do it anyway. So I think part of Dharma practice is slowing down so we can really look at the choices we're making and think about the results of the choices that we're making. Now, not only long-term choices, but even short-term choices, because our short-term choices lead to long-term ones, don't they? Sometimes one small choice can, you know, change so many things that happen afterwards. And so to pay attention to our choices, because we care about the effects, and the effects on ourselves, the effects on others around us. Okay. So thinking about these things, important, isn't it? Yeah. Sometimes we're just kind of, we just shine things on. Oh, my choices, oh, my actions, oh, who cares? Oh. You know? And then, boy, we wind up in trouble afterwards, don't we? So, mind training like raises the sun is teaching us how to make good choices. Okay? And to make good choices, we have to learn to think properly and to differentiate what's virtuous, what's non-virtuous. Okay? And we have to know how to create virtuous states of mind, you know, how to cultivate them. Yeah? And then we also need to know specific things, guidelines, what to do and what not to do. And that's one thing about the section that we're on right now in the thought training. We're talking about the commitments of thought training, and then the next section after that is the precepts of thought training. And a lot of these are just very short instructions, you know, do this and don't do that, okay? And it's very helpful, you know, even for those of us who don't like people to tell us what to do. You know, we're very funny. We don't want anybody to tell us what to do. But then when people don't tell us what to do, we feel very lost and we say, I need some structure. Tell me how I'm supposed to put this into practice. Isn't that strange how we are? You know? If somebody just says, okay, do this job, then we go, I don't know what I'm doing. Why don't they give me more direction? And if they say, do it this way, this way, this way, we go, what are you bossing me around for? Okay, Meshuggah. It's Meshuggah, isn't it? Totally Meshuggah. You know what Meshuggah means? It's Yiddish for crazy, you know. Somebody who's Meshuggah, they're nuts, you know. You're not making, doing things wisely. Yeah. Okay. So that's what we're like, aren't we? You know? Okay, so now we're on the section called The Irreversible Commitments of Mind Training. And it has two parts, the explanation of what appears in the text in verse and of what appears in the text as maxims. So first, what appears in the text in verse? Okay, so I guess this is how the text is written in Tibetan. Okay, so here it's giving us some instructions, do this and don't do that. So you blame Namkha Pel if you don't want to be bossed around, huh? Don't blame me. Maybe you should praise Namkha Pel for telling you what to do. Shouldn't we? Yeah? Wise of guidance here. So he says, always train in the three great points. Always train in the three great points. Okay. So he says, these are as follows. Okay? Mind training that is not contradictory to the commitments. Okay? So mind training that doesn't transgress our commitments, our pledges. Okay, mind training which is not led astray, and mind training which is impartial. Okay, so let's, he describes them. Firstly, we should never act in contradiction to the practices common to all vehicles, saying there's no harm in this because I'm training the mind, when we break some minor commitment, claiming that nothing else is required of us as a follower of the mind training. Okay, so this is the mind training that of not transgressing the pledges, you know, the three important points. Don't transgress the pledges. Okay, so we should never act in contradiction to the practices in common to all the vehicles. In other words, to the refuge guidelines, the five precepts, the monastic precepts, the basic general practices, the ten non-virtues. Okay, so we should never act in contradiction to these things, saying, well, there's no harm in me doing that because I'm practicing the mind training. In other words, these are kind of like, you know, trivial practices, and, you know, I'm a great practitioner of mind training, so I don't need to follow these. But, you know, the ten, abandoning the ten non-virtues, keeping the ten virtues, that's the core of the whole path for all the vehicles. Yeah, so it's very important that we keep that in mind and follow that. Okay? On the contrary, we should train in practicing the Buddha's teachings in its entirety, from the instruction on basic logic up to Guhya Samaja Tantra. Okay? And so, you know, this is for the mind. You know, sometimes people say, well, I'm a higher practitioner, so I don't need to do these small practices. Yeah, and that's not the right attitude. If you look at the really great masters, they do the small practices very well. Yeah, like even in our Vinaya, we have, you know, etiquette things, like we're wearing our robes properly and so on. You look at His Holiness, he always wears his robes properly. Yeah, they're not sloppy, they're not here and there. Yeah, so even the small things, to keep those well, and have respect for all the guidelines that the Buddha teaches. Okay? Then the second point, okay, this is led astray. Okay? So secondly, we should avoid digging harmful earth, felling sinister trees, stirring noxious waters, visiting those afflicted by contagious diseases without precaution, or associating by view or behavior with those who are morally corrupt or possessed by spirits. Okay? We should follow the pure and unbroken tradition descending from the great Atisha, the sole divine Lord, to the all-knowing Tsongkhapa and his disciples. So what this is talking about, okay, not to be led astray, is somebody who practices thought training but gets kind of arrogant about it. And says, I'm a very, you know, high practitioner doing thought training, so I can dig the earth that where other creatures live and, you know, stir them up, but nothing's going to happen to me. Okay? I can fell, you know, when it says sinister trees, what it's talking about, maybe there's some spirits. This is based on Tibetan culture, okay? You know, spirits, and think, oh, well, the spirits won't harm me. Or the Nagas won't harm me. Or stirring noxious waters, you know, again, the same kind of thing. Visiting those afflicted by contagious diseases without taking any precautions and thinking, well, I won't get sick because I practice thought training. Okay? So, you know, just being a little kind of arrogant. Yeah? Oh, I don't need to do this because, you know, nothing's going to happen to me. I can do all these dangerous things because, you know, I'm not going to fall off the ladder. I'm not going to get killed in the car accident. I'm not going to, you know, I can drink and hold it. Nothing bad is going to happen to me. You know, this kind of mind that is kind of arrogant, thinking, well, because I practice the Dharma, because I practice thought training, then nothing bad is going to happen to me. And so we become quite careless in our behavior. Okay, so that's what the second one is. Okay, it's a kind of arrogance, isn't it? Yeah. Oh, I can, you know, cheat on this and cheat on that. Nobody's going to know. Nobody, you know, that kind of thing. Okay, and so it's saying we should instead follow the pure and unbroken tradition from Atisha to Jay Rinpoche and really, you know, follow the tradition well and with respect. Okay. Then thirdly, we should be impartial about the object of our mind training, whether it is human or non-humans, friends, foes, or strangers, people who are superior, inferior, or equal, those that are high, middling, or low. Okay. So when we practice mind training, we should practice it in relationship to everybody. Yeah, we don't just practice mind training in relationship to important people so that we don't lose our temper and look bad in front of them, you know. So I practice mind training when I'm with them because I want to have a good reputation, I want to look good, you know. But with people that I think are inferior, I don't need to practice mind training because who cares what they think of me, I can be rude, yeah. Or, you know, I only... you know, abandon non-virtue in circumstances, you know, like when people are looking at me, but when I'm alone in my room, I do whatever because nobody's there. We do that, huh?
Uh-oh.
Yeah. But, okay, so, you know, being kind of partial towards who we practice mind training with, what situations we practice mind training with. Yeah. So this is because we should practice compassion without distinction towards all sentient beings under the sky. So not just practicing compassion with the people we like and forgetting compassion when there's people who we don't like or people we disrespect. Yeah. Not practicing love and compassion with people who are kind to us and praise us, and then we forget about it with people who are mean. Or even the opposite, practicing thought training with people who are kind of mean, but then treating the people who are nice to us very flippantly and not taking care of them. Yeah, that's another thing we can do, isn't it? It's not always that we favor the people we like and mistreat others. Sometimes we take such good care of, you know, kind of strangers or people that we consider, you know, ill or you know, needy. But then the people who we live with, we just take them for granted and, you know, just whatever. Okay? So to not have that attitude either, practice love and compassion with everybody. Given that the disturbing emotions in our mind streams, the objects to be abandoned, are to be subdued, it is not sufficient to apply a partial or alternative remedy. In other words, we don't just apply remedies to some of the afflictions, but not to others. Okay? Like, I'm going to work on my anger, but, well, attachment doesn't matter. Yeah, everybody has attachment. They'll understand if I act with attachment. Yeah. But anger, you know, I better practice because that doesn't look so good. Okay? So that kind of mind, I'm only going to practice with some afflictions and not others. We should train in understanding the way the antidotes are to be applied in general without partiality to the disturbing emotions. Okay, so to understand how to apply the antidotes in general, for example, how to use the meditation on impermanence, on selflessness, those are general antidotes to all the afflictions, and then also to know the individual antidotes for specific afflictions. This is because all these disturbing emotions are obstructions to liberation and omniscience and are equal in dragging us into the miseries of cyclic existence. So we need to be impartial if we are to have an unbiased attitude towards all. Okay, so practicing in an impartial way in terms of the sentient beings that we practice mind training with and in terms of the afflictions that we use mind training to counteract. Okay? So, you know, it what it means is like trying to be consistent as a human being. It's not that we're polite with important people, but impolite with, you know, people that we consider inferior. Yeah? Or that we put on a good appearance for, you know, benefactors, and then we say whatever to, you know, other people. So really trying to act in an equal, you know, practice in an equal way towards everybody. So not just towards human beings, but also towards animals and insects. You know, to be kind to all of our animal friends and our insect friends as well. Okay. Now, the text goes on to the second one. The text says, engage vigorously in forceful cultivation and abandonment. Okay? Now, we hear forceful and we go, oh, tension, stress, forceful cultivation, forceful abandonment. That's not what it means, you know. Okay. In general, we are not supposed to employ force towards human or non-human beings because it will provoke their anger. Right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, when we act, here force means, I think, aggressively instead of maybe forcefully. Well, if we want to practice forcefully for cultivation and abandonment, but when force goes into aggression, okay, so if we act aggressively, forcefully in that way towards human beings, you know, it provokes their anger. Yeah, then we wind up with difficult relationships. And then also with non-human beings. So we provoke their anger, then people or the non-human beings also, then they hold a grudge against us. Okay, then they harm us in this life, or maybe in a future life we're brought together in such a way that they inflict harm on us then because of our behavior towards them now. Okay. They might harm us this life, future lives, as well as in the intermediate state. Yeah. So just being aware of, you know, how we treat other beings and that it's going to provoke a reaction. And sometimes we're so surprised when other people are upset with us. Yeah. Kind of, what did I do? And, you know, oblivious that maybe, you know, we acted in an inconsiderate way, or we were backbiting, or we weren't very reliable, or something like that. Okay? Or we were angersome. You know, we dumped on them, we let our anger out, then we're wondering why they're in a bad mood towards us, or why they hold a grudge towards us. Okay? Amongst human beings, we should not behave forcefully towards those who have been kind to us, or even towards our relatives and servants. Otherwise, the help they have previously given us will become worthless and a cause for anger. So I think what it means here, yeah, not being aggressive towards those who've been kind to us, towards relatives, towards those who help us, yeah. Otherwise, the previous help they have given us will become worthless. I don't think it means that it's worthless, but they may come to regret the help that they gave us. And that's not very good for their minds. Okay? And then the previous help that they gave us might even become a cause of anger for them because they regret it and, you know, and so I was such a fool for helping so-and-so. And, you know, then when other people think like that, then they destroy their merit. Okay, towards whom then should we be forceful? So if we're not going to be forceful and aggressive towards sentient beings, then what are we going to be forceful and aggressive towards? In general, all the faults of cyclic existence arise from their origin, karma or actions and disturbing emotions. And actions or karma are produced because of disturbing emotions. So if we're going to be forceful, you know, if we're going to point the finger and say, get out of here, yeah, that's what we should point the finger towards, is the disturbing emotions, you know, because they're what create the karma, which lead to the dukkha. Since amongst all disturbing emotions, the grasping at self is chief, all of our spiritual practices of hearing, contemplation, and meditation involving our body, speech, and mind should be concentrated forcefully on eliminating it. So since the ignorance, you know, the self-grasping ignorance is the root of all the afflictions, then we should focus all of our hearing, thinking, and meditating on eliminating it. Okay? So I think this is important because sometimes we might think, oh, you know, eliminating ignorance, that means realizing emptiness. Emptiness is difficult. You know, all these pervasions and counter-pervasions and big words, and I can't understand it, so I'm just going to leave emptiness aside. You know, we could easily think like that. So that's not a good way to think. Rather, what we should do is whatever understanding we have of emptiness, you know, try and reflect on it and apply it to the things that we see in our daily life. Okay, so that we get some more, we feel a little bit more in tune with the nature of reality, and we're continuing our study and reflection on it. Okay, so with regard to the method by which to do this, the Guide to a Bodhisattva's Way of Life says, to do this, in other words, to obliterate the afflictions, will be my sole obsession. So if you're going to have OCD, this is what you have to have. Okay? This has got to be your obsession, getting rid of the afflictions. Holding a strong grudge, I shall meet them in battle. So here, a disturbing emotion can destroy other disturbing emotions, but not otherwise. Okay, so what this is talking about is, you know, we say, okay, destroying the afflictions, this is going to be my obsession, and I'm going to hold a strong grudge against them, and I'm going to destroy them in battle. Okay, so this is very kind of inflammatory language, isn't it, in a way? Yeah? Let's see, obsession, you know, as Buddhists, we shouldn't cultivate obsession, and you know, holding strong grudge, that's not very Buddhist. Why am I doing that? So what Shantideva is saying is here, you're not holding, it's not a usual kind of obsession, it's not a usual kind of grudge, but here he's saying that a disturbing emotion can destroy other disturbing emotions, in the sense that if you're going to be fixated on something, then be fixated on destroying the ignorance, because that will destroy it. And if you're going to have strong aversion towards something, have strong aversion towards afflictions and karma, because that will give you the energy to oppose them. Okay? So some people, this kind of language, and Shantideva uses it a lot, the kind of warrior language, some people really like that language, and they find it very helpful, and, you know, I'm a spiritual warrior, and opposing the afflictions, and some people find that language very helpful, and some people don't find it helpful at all. They find that they need language that is much more gentle, much more accepting, much softer language. So, you know, regardless of which kind of person we are, we have to understand the language of the other way of saying it, so that we don't fall into an extreme. Okay. So if you're the person who likes this kind of strong language, then when somebody is talking about self-acceptance and gentleness, you know, don't go, oh, well, that's just wimpy, but try and understand what they're talking about. And similarly, if you're the person who likes the softer language about acceptance and being gentle with yourself and being kind to yourself, then when somebody else is saying, you know, I'm going to be a warrior and smash my afflictions, you know, don't get upset with them, because that's the way that it makes, you know, that works for them. Okay? So the idea is we need to understand the meaning behind all these different kinds of language. Because some teachers may use one language, some teachers may use the other, but we have to understand what they're trying to say, instead of just, you know, having our knee-jerk reaction. Yeah. And I was talking with, I was talking with somebody this last week about how sometimes we hear just certain kind of language and we automatically react against it. You know, there might be certain ways of putting things in some of our recitations. Yeah, it was here. Yeah. And we just hear that language and we go, ooh, you know, kind of, because it's a real button-pushing language for us personally. Yeah. And then we just, you know, we go back to our old associations with that kind of language. And so it's very important, you know, when we have that kind of language, either, you know, our teacher uses it or it's written in the recitations we do, that we try and understand what it means and don't just be so reactive to the language. Okay? Yeah? Because sometimes, you know, I mean, I've seen it in myself, I'll take the language just the way I always have, and then, you know, self-centeredness is, you know, our worst enemy. And then you take that and say, but I'm my self-centeredness, so I'm my worst enemy, I hate myself. That's the wrong conclusion. Okay, we have to understand what the meaning of the teaching is. It's not about hating ourselves. Okay, one of my big ones was pleasing the spiritual master, because I was hearing pleasing God. You know, which was a big button pusher for me, because, you know, you please God, but you don't know what the rules are. Yeah? And if you don't please, well, then you're in big trouble. So, you know, and also, you know, it was a very parental kind of language, you know, be a good girl and please somebody. And so I reacted so strongly to that. And then I had to really sit down and think about, well, what does that language really mean? You know, it doesn't mean be a good girl and do what somebody else wants. That's not the meaning. Okay? The meaning is, you know, our spiritual masters want nothing more than for us to be happy and to create the causes of happiness. So when we create the causes of happiness, they're very happy. So we please them. So, you know, creating virtue, that's what we want to do anyway. We're not doing it for the purpose of winning brownie points with somebody else. But, you know, that's the meaning of that language, to do what pleases the spiritual master. Okay? Yeah. So other people may like other language, like do what's good for you. Yeah. Oh, do what's good for me. That's good. I'll do what's good for me. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But then, oh, well, what's good for me is a half gallon of ice cream right now. Yeah. So then you have to understand what that means. It doesn't, just mean indulge. It means, you know, think about, well, what really is good for me? Yeah. What does that really mean? Okay? So there's different kinds of language. I'm just trying to say, don't get too locked into language, because sometimes, you know, because we'll notice that even, you know, in our normal interactions with each other, somebody will say one word and we have a story with that word, and we go ballistic when we hear it, you know? And we put all of our meanings on this one word or this one comment, and just go completely, our mind just like goes, you know, this person is, and you know, they just said kind of one word or made one comment. But because, you know, there's some sentence or sentence structure or something, you know, that we have a big button about, then our mind gets all out of whack. Does that happen? Oh, you do it? Really? Nobody else here does. I think they do. Yeah, I don't think you are either. You're just truthful about it. Okay, Shanti Deva continues. It would be better for me to be burned, to have my head cut off and be killed, than ever bowing down to my enemies, the ubiquitous disturbing emotions. Okay? So that's pretty forceful, you know. It would be better for me to be burned, to have my head cut off and be killed, you know, than to ever bow down to my enemies, the ubiquitous disturbing emotions. So that it doesn't, what that mean, it doesn't mean that every time you say a mean word to somebody, you should, you know, go cut off your head, okay? Or think, you know, I deserve to die rather than criticize this person, you know? That's not the meaning of this. But what Shanti Deva is saying is, when we really see that the disturbing emotions, the afflictions, are the real thing that creates unhappiness for ourselves and others, then we should have some energy and we should stand up to them, you know? Instead of just succumbing to them and, oh, I've got to be compassionate to the afflictions, you know, something like that. No, we should stand up for them and think, you know, if I give in to this affliction, that's like really damaging. That's going to cause me, you know, much more suffering in the future, because that affliction will send me to the lower realms, whereas having my head cut off in this life, you know, the worst that happens is I die, that's it. Yeah? So from that viewpoint, you can see, yeah, you know, rather than just buy into our afflictions and keep going on and on and on with them, yeah, we should stand up to them and say to ourselves, you know, why am I doing this? It's better that I lose this one life than create the cause of suffering for so many future lives. Okay, so we use that in a way in which we give ourselves some energy to stand up to the afflictions. Okay, you getting what I say? Yeah? And really, it makes us think about how harmful the afflictions are, because sometimes we are way too patient with the afflictions, aren't we? You know, we're too gentle and compassionate with our afflictions. Oh, anger, you want to say something mean to somebody else, go right ahead. Yeah. Oh, anger, you want to beat me up? Yeah, you can criticize, you know, we can get into some self-criticism. Oh, attachment, you want to take something that belongs to somebody else because you want it. Doesn't matter. Okay? So, you know, we shouldn't be indulgent of the afflictions in this kind of way. Yeah? Because it just winds up detrimental in the long run. Okay? So we must persevere in combating the self-grasping and familiarize ourselves with concern for others. That's the conclusion. Okay? Regarding what we must do to give up our self-centered attitude, the text says, subjugate all the reasons for selfishness, for self-centeredness. That's the root text. Subjugate all the reasons for self-centeredness. We should suppress every instance of attachment and hatred that gives rise to exaggerated prejudices about friends, foes, or strangers, the attractive and the unattractive. That is because worldly phenomena in general are unreliable, and relations between friends and foes in particular are uncertain. Okay? So every instance of attachment and hatred, yeah, every instance of exaggerated prejudices, of inappropriate attention that says, oh, this is really good, wonderful, this is really bad, awful, I have to have this, oh, I've got to get rid of that. You know, all this kind of reactionary, you know, emotions and behavior towards friends, foes, or strangers, okay, as well as towards what's attractive and what's unattractive. Yeah. So all this kind, this yo-yo mind, basically, yeah, the yo-yo mind that is you know, drawn to this and I have to have it, and pushes against that, I can't stand it. Yeah. So, you know, the mind that's so reactionary. Yeah. Is that the right use of the word reactionary? Yeah. So reactionary also means like old fat, you know, backwards or something like that. But, yeah, we're just knee-jerk reaction, you know. Tip, boing. Yeah, button pushes. Okay, so to really slow down and look at the prejudices we have. And look at the way that we create biases for or against certain people as individuals, certain groups of people. Okay. Because all of that is pretty deadly. Now, whenever we start generalizing, and, you know, there may be general characteristics shared by certain people, but to think that everybody in that group has that characteristic, yeah, that's not a very helpful way of thinking. And so to be aware of that, because lots of times we've been conditioned in that way from the time we were young. You know, we were told by our parents to talk to certain people and not talk to other people, okay? Or with our friends in school, you know, it's good to hang out with some people but not hang out with other people. And then, you know, even what goes on in the media now, the way there's so much prejudice flying around. And so to really be quite attentive and not let our mind proliferate about those kinds of things, towards groups of people or towards individuals. Okay? And the reason for this is because worldly phenomena in general are unreliable, and relationships between friends and foes in particular are uncertain. Okay, so worldly things in general are unreliable. Why? Because they are impermanent. Okay, so they have the characteristic of gross impermanence, many of them, in the sense that they will, you know, completely split up so that they're no longer recognizable as that phenomena they were before. The house, you know, will fall apart and you can't recognize that it's a house or something like that. A person will die. That's the gross impermanence. But then everything is subject also to subtle impermanence. Just the fact that from every single instant, it's arising and disintegrating, arising and disintegrating, without any moment of actual abiding in stability, just constant arising and disintegrating. So this is the nature of all phenomena, and you know, quite in accord with science, you know. And so it's saying, you know, with all the phenomena around us, arising and ceasing in each split second, and particularly relationships between friends and foes are very uncertain. Okay, they're changing in each split second, but also sometimes in bigger chunks of time, over an hour, over a day, over a year. You know, we can watch how our relationships with people change. It's amazing, isn't it? Yeah? If you think, you know, 10 years ago, who were you close to? Yeah? Who are you close to? Okay. The end of 1999. That's where we are, right? Who were you close to then? Yeah? And are you close to some of those same people now? Yeah? And have those people changed? If you're close to some of the same people, have they changed? Is the relationship the same as it was before? Yeah? So some people who were foes before have become friends. Some people who were friends have become foes. You know, things are changing all the time. Yeah, not very stable, not very certain. Yeah, and so because of that, why buy into all of our proliferating thoughts about so-and-so's like this and so-and-so's like that? Yeah, it doesn't make any sense, does it, considering how in flux all these things are. So the friendly letter says, who wrote the friendly letter? Nagarjuna. Okay, it says your father becomes your son, your mother your wife, and your enemies become friends. The opposite also takes place. Therefore, in cyclic existence, there is no certainty at all. Yeah? So, you know, the people that we relate to in a certain way this lifetime, in a previous lifetime, you know, we had totally different conventional relationships with them. In a future lifetime, we might also have very different conventional relationships. People who were our parents last time, this time are our children. People who were friends before are foes now. People who, you know, employed us before, now we employ them. All these things constantly changing. Okay? And so for that reason, to kind of latch on to certain people and say, but these people are, you know, more this, that, or the other thing than anybody else, doesn't make much sense. You know, because in 100 years, we're going to be in a totally different relationship with them. At the maximum in 100 years. Probably fewer. Yeah? Because I doubt any of us will be alive in 100 years. Yeah? And so, you know, then all the relationships, the people that we're so close to now, we may not even know. We may have one kind of relationship with them now. You know, maybe next lifetime. I don't know. How will we meet? You know, what kind of relationships will we have? You know? And so for this reason, not to get too locked into, you know, but this person is, you know, so meaningful in this way, or this person is so awful, you know? So it's just all going to change, isn't it? Yeah, people, you know, nothing, none of these things have any essence. People don't have fixed, concrete personalities, do they? Yeah? So we might say, oh, but I love their personality. Well, they're not going to have that personality for so long. Even in this life, you know, people don't have a consistent personality, do they? Yeah? or the relationship we're in with them this life. You know, next life, we may be born 10 bazillion universes away. Yeah, not even know them. Yeah. And if you look, I mean, you can see a person is just merely labeled in dependence upon whatever aggregates are there. There's nothing there inside of a person that is some kind of, you know, ultimate personality or soul or something that they really are. Yeah? It's all just changing. And that also means we can all become Buddhas. It's a good reason not to grasp. And there's also a saying, construct a fort where the danger is greatest. In other words, yeah, relating this to the previous thing, you know, of not, you know, how we should suppress every instance of attachment and aversion and bias and things like that. So construct the fort where the danger is greatest. So where you have the greatest bias, the greatest anger, the greatest attachment, work on those things first. Yeah. And I think that's very important in our practice to really know, you know, what are the areas that are the biggest problems for us and work on those. You know, what are the behaviors that are really the most detrimental? Yeah. What are the emotions that really, you know, sway us in a bad way most strongly? And so to know that and really work with those things instead of obsessing about, you know, small things. We'll get to the small things, but it's more worthwhile if we work with the big things. Okay, so it is necessary to meditate on the factors which cause your spiritual practice to decline. And the text says, train consistently to deal with difficult situations. Okay, so that's the instruction, so that we will meditate on the factors which can cause our spiritual practice to decline, which are difficult situations, right? Difficult situations that provoke difficult emotions, that provoke unwholesome behavior. Yeah, so train consistently to deal with these difficult situations. So then the text lists five kinds of difficult situations. There's probably more, but you know, we'll just talk about five right now. First, since even the slightest misbehavior towards the three jewels, your abbot, spiritual master, parents, and so forth, who are all very kind to you, is extremely serious, you should be careful not to lose your temper with them. Okay? So, because the three jewels, our abbot, our spiritual master, our parents, you know, all these are people who have been very kind to us in this particular lifetime. So any of the karma that we create with them is especially strong, either non-virtuous karma or virtuous karma. So because they are powerful objects with which we create the karma, we should be very careful not to lose our temper with them. Okay? Because when we lose our temper, we say and do all sorts of things, don't we? And that can be very, very dangerous, you know, especially, I mean, anger can even cause somebody to, you know, walk out on their parents or on their spiritual master or, you know, to steal, to denigrate, to do all sorts of things that are really very, very detrimental to our own practice. So it's something to take care of. Now, of course, sometimes anger arises, doesn't it? Yeah. So then, you know, we need to catch it before it comes out of our mouth or gets expressed in our actions, and try and, you know, do some meditation to calm ourselves down. If it does come out, to go and apologize. Yeah. And to try and, you know, really subdue our mind in that regard. Okay, secondly, as there are many opportunities for disturbing emotions to arise in relation to members of your family, because you live with them all the time, this requires special training. Okay? So not only, you know, Three Jewels, our abbot, spiritual master, parents, but also our family. So I think this means not only our biological family, but here our spiritual family. Because these are the people you live with, you live with them all the time, so it requires special attention. Yeah? Because the people that we're around all the time, sometimes we take for granted, we stop appreciating their kindness. We also have the habit of picking their faults. Yeah? And also, because when we spend more time with people, we have a chance to notice them better. So, you know, we will see their faults, and then especially if we like to pick faults, we can really get into it. Okay? And then when we pick faults with our family, either our biological family or our spiritual family, then we tend to be putting them down, so we do things that are not very nice. Then we also gossip about them behind their back, and we tell other people stories about them, and then we create factions, people who are on my side and the people who are their side. Yeah. And then, you know, the whole thing becomes very, very polarized. Yeah. I was just reading an article about somebody was saying that they work for a business. And one of the principles, you know, if you're going to get hired by that, is that no gossip is tolerated in the office. Yeah? And this person was saying, wow, that's, you know, I've never heard that being, you know, kind of something that was said in the hiring process, you know, the interview process. No gossip is tolerated. And that, and she said it makes working there actually quite a joy. Yeah? Because, you know, nobody's going to talk about you behind your back. And if they do, then somebody's going to call them on it. Yeah, and so then you also, yeah, so, you know, to not kind of gossip behind people's backs. Sometimes we might need to exchange information so that people know what's going on with somebody so that we can help, but that's quite different, I think, than gossiping, yeah, and putting people down, creating factions. Okay, we have a little, I didn't get through all five of the difficulties, but I thought maybe I should leave some time for questions, if you have any.
Mm-hmm. I thought I had a question to clear up. Mm-hmm. You mentioned one of the things last week was when you're checking in to see what your progress is, there are two sources. One is outside of yourself and one inside of yourself. And so the question came back, well then what about your teacher? Wouldn't their reflections on your progress be more important than your own observations of your progress?
Oh, okay. So when we were talking last week about the two witnesses, yeah, the internal witness that evaluates our progress and the external witness, and that that the internal witness is the most important. And so your question is, well, what about the feedback from our teacher? Yeah, how does that fit? So I think that that's quite important, because our teacher often sees things in us that we can't see in ourselves. Yeah, but we should also, you know, not just take what the teacher says and go, okay, you know, that's more true than my own internal feeling, okay? We need to develop some ability to think about what our teacher says and to see what that means in terms of our own practice. What I'm saying is, we don't give up our own wisdom, okay? So, let's think of some kind of example. So our teacher may say, you know, you're being kind of lazy and you need to put some more effort into your practice. Yeah, it would be helpful to put more effort into your practice, okay? So then we have to look inside and say, okay, am I lazy? Yeah, and what does that mean when the teacher says I'm being lazy and I need to put more energy in? What does that mean? Yeah, because, and why I say this is because we'll hear that kind of thing and immediately we go, I'm not doing it right. My teacher says I'm lazy, I need to put more energy in my practice. That means I'm not doing it right. I'm just, you know, completely a slob. I'm not worthy. We go into all these kinds of trips over just a little bit of feedback. Okay? So that's why I say that we don't give up our wisdom and just go back into these knee-jerk reactions that we have. But like, okay, when my teacher said I'm being lazy, well, what does that mean? Well, what are the different kinds of laziness? Yeah? Well, there's the laziness of, you know, lolling around. There's the laziness of being too busy with samsaric things. And there's the laziness of self-deprecation. Well, which one of those am I involved in? Which one of those are they talking about? Yeah, and to what extent? And look inside. Yeah, okay, well, I do loll around a lot, but, you know, I waste more time putting myself down than I do oversleeping. Yeah? Or I waste more time being busy doing samsaric things than I do with oversleeping. Or for other people, you know, it might be the opposite. So we have to, you know, think about what our teacher understands, the feedback they give us, and make sure we understand it properly. Okay? But often, you know, our teachers will see potential in us that we don't see in ourselves. And our teacher will ask us to do something, and we just start backpedaling and making up excuses and joking and this, that, and the other thing, instead of really taking the challenge and, you know, seeing, oh, you know, they see some potential in me. I need to step up to the plate here and see if I can develop this. Is that making some sense to you? Okay. Yeah. So it's the same whenever we get any feedback. We always need to see, you know, kind of what does it really mean? Because even good feedback, you know, somebody says, oh, you're such a nice person. Then we go, oh, well, I'm perfect in every way. You know, whereas maybe what they're meaning isn't, you know, last Tuesday you were being courteous to some visitors or something. But, you know, we'll just go, oh, I don't need to improve at all. Okay? So, yeah. It's the usual thing of communication, isn't it?
I have a question about Tonglen. So when I take on suffering or release, that in my mind and that
it does
expand my mind, it opens my heart. It's a positive feeling, and then when I become a wish fulfilling jewel, that's a very good thing. But the part that is kind of a mystery to me right now is reducing the self-cherishing, the smashing of this love. So I'm not really, I don't know what's going on there. I don't know if it's happening. I don't.
Okay, so you're saying that when you did the taking and giving meditation, taking on other sentient beings' suffering expands your mind, and is very good. And becoming a wish-fulfilling gem and giving them happiness feels very good. But smashing your self-centered thought is a big puzzle to you. Well, maybe you have to think about what your self-centered thought is and how it comes up and how it makes a mess in your life, yeah? So that you can really see clearly what the self-centered thought is, so that you want to destroy it. Otherwise, you know, I take on others' suffering, I give them my happiness, it all becomes a feel-good meditation, but we're not challenging that mind that says, I want, I have to have it like this. Yeah, don't tell me what to do. Okay, so we have to kind of see what that mind is. And consider destroying it. Yeah. Because if it's, you know, I think that's a very important point of the taking and giving meditation. We don't just take on others' suffering and, you know, oh, I take on their suffering, now I'm suffering, they're free. No, you know, sitting there suffering doesn't do any good. Yeah? So we have to use what they don't want to destroy what we don't want. Their suffering to destroy our afflictions, our self-centeredness. So we have to really have a strong intention to destroy our self-centeredness. Huh? And normally we don't have a very strong intention to destroy it. We have a very strong intention to preserve it. And we will often sometimes even use the Dharma in ways, you know, that preserve our self-centeredness. So we have to, you know, really see it and want to oppose it. But this is a process. It doesn't mean that we, you know, should get all uptight every time, you know, I do one small self-centered thing thinking I'm a failure. Yeah, I mean, this is a process. Okay. It's so interesting saying things to you people because some of you are so different. And if I say one thing to you, I'm afraid somebody else is going to misinterpret it. And if I say something to that person, I'm afraid you're going to misinterpret it. You know? Because people are so different. Just what I was talking about how we understand words and what thing are our buttons. Yeah? So. Yeah? It's true, isn't it? Anything else? Okay. And we'll continue later. So we've had the first 2 points about our families, people we're with around all the time, and then about our parents and mentors and abbots and three jewels. Okay, and everything else. So, you know, review these teachings in between sessions. And then try and put them into practice, you know, in your day as much as you can. So it might be good if we all thought of one behavior that we really want to work on. Yeah, think of one physical and verbal behavior we want to work on, and then look at what the mind behind that is, and make it, you know, kind of work on that mind too, because it's not just a question of changing the outer behavior, it's a question of changing the inner mind. And so think of maybe something that you really want to work on, and then, you know, inside and outside, and then see how the thought training practice can be used to help us do that. What might be interesting is if we ask other people what they think we should work on. Woo! Yeah? But it could be very interesting. Okay.
May the spiritual teachers who lead you on the sacred path, and all spiritual friends who practice it have long life. May I pacify completely all outer and inner hindrances. Grant such inspiration, I pray. May the lives of the venerable spiritual masters be stable, and their divine action spread in the 10 directions. May the light of Losung's teachings dispelling the darkness of the beings in the 3 worlds always increase. Vakra Mandala Kamniryataya Me.
Due to this merit,
may we soon attain the enlightened state of Guru Buddha, that we may be able to liberate all sentient beings from their suffering. May the precious Bodhi mind not yet born arise and grow. May the born of no decline but increase forevermore. In the snowy mountain paradise, you're the source of good and happiness. Powerful Tenzin Gyatso Chenrezi, may you stay until samsara ends.
May the deeds of
explaining and practicing the Dharma, those by groups supporting the teachings and their upholders, who spread the view of dependent arising and non-violent actions in the ten directions, and especially at Shravasti Abbey in the West Glory.